Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. Can I say that something? I want to hold your hand.
The Beatles, John, Paul, George, and Ringo, took the world by storm in the early 1960s with an irresistible charm and energy. And then, in full view on the biggest stage in the world, they kept changing. Their sound evolving, deepening, getting ever richer, more creative, more inventive, fusing old and new. The man behind much of that, legendary producer George Martin. He died this week. This hour on Point, the great musical alliance of the Beatles and Sir George Martin. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio, Tim Riley, music critic, rock culture chronicler, author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles, album by album, song by song, the 60s and after, and Lennon, the man, the myth, the music, the definitive life. Tim Riley, welcome back to On Point. So great to have you this week.
Good to see you, Tom.
Wow. I just got out of the habit of listening to the Beatles, and for this show I went back, and the joy just pours out, and I thought to myself, I got to listen more often. Music has become dark and kind of morose. There's a joy and inventiveness even here in this one before they really get going with Sir George.
Right.
That is amazing to put back in your ears.
Yeah, and the thing that you're noticing there has a lot to do with this man we're talking about today, George Martin, because his job as producer is to give you a direct access to all that energy and charisma and joy you're hearing.
Even here, I'm hearing George Martin. This is 1964.
It's 1964.
Is Fingerprints already on this?
Oh, of course. Yeah, because this is actually an early four-track recording the Beatles made. They just graduated from two-track machines to four-track machines.
Yep.
So when you study the career of the Beatles, you're also studying the career of the development of the technology, the studio technology that was happening at the same time, and the Beatles were actually taking advantage and pushing their engineers and their producer to do studio effects, sound effects, overdubbing effects that were literally out of reach to a lot of these old analog machines. Now,
and then, of course, he was a great studio wizard himself, George Martin.
He was, and he has a very interesting pre-Beatles career where he developed some of these techniques in advance of the Beatles. And so when you go back and you study the history, it's almost cosmic to realize that these two people found each other, because George Martin, it's almost like he'd been preparing for the Beatles to arrive. And when they arrived, he found the perfect band to continue the kind of experimenting and innovation that he was already doing in the studio.
Let's just hear the man himself. This is 2011. He talked to the BBC's Arena show. He recalled his first meeting with the Beatles, 1962. He says he signed them not so much for their music, but really for their personality.
They had this wonderful charisma. They made you feel good to be with them.
Mm.
And I thought their music was rubbish.
I thought their music was rubbish. Okay, who is this guy, George Martin, who would simultaneously recognize the charisma of the Beatles and think their music was rubbish? Who was he? Where did he come from?
Well, so he has this very interesting background. He comes from northern London. He is actually from a working-class background. His dad was a carpenter, and when he went into the Royal Navy, he self-consciously changed his accent.
Went to more mainstream.
And adopted what they call over there the BBC accent, is actually a good career move for many people in that era, right?
Sure.
Because you're never gonna try and pretend to be upper class, but if you can sound and talk like the upper class, that actually makes you respectable.
What was he doing in all those years before the Beatles that brought him loaded for Bear?
Joins EMI and Parlophone Records, and he does a mentorship with a famous producer at the time named Oscar Proust, and he records all different kinds of things. recordings all throughout the 50s, but he develops a niche for recording comedy albums and soundtrack albums, and he actually records some rather famous comedy records that actually chart. And this was actually seen as his specialty with Parlophone Records was the comedy
angle. Peter Sellers, Peter Ustinov,
the Goon Show people, Spike Milligan. And when he meets John Lennon, John Lennon makes this connection. Aha, I love the Goon Show. And this guy worked with us, so he must be okay. It's a very important connection they make there.
I have a little sound of that. This is from way back, a decade before he met them, 1952. This was George Martin's first hit with Peter Ustinov's Mach Mozart.
That's
this
right.
is not the Beatles at all, but this is back in the cupboard. Here we go. Okay. What is going on here? This makes the British laugh. It makes me laugh, I guess. But but the Beatles are buried in that? What?
Well, so it's fake Mozart. That's the first thing I'm saying.
It's a send-up.
It's faux Mozart. But it's actually one person doing both those voices. It is Peter Ustinov.
Uh-huh.
And George Martin figures out a way to take two mono machines, single-track machines, and overdub and splice the tape on top of each other.
So he's playful, creative, innovative already
there. Well, this is right. This had not been done. So he is one of the early people to say, you know what? We don't have to just replicate a performance on tape. We can actually use tape to create something new. All right. And that idea is very, very prominent throughout his whole career. And the fact that he does it in 1952, you can imagine the young John Lennon sitting and listening to that
and
record.
Laughing and having fun.
Having a holler about it.
Martin was also classically trained. I mean, the Baroque he knew very well, and that plays a huge role later with the Beatles in the mid-60s as that all that comes out.
Yes, so he goes to the Guildhall School of Music. He studies piano and oboe. And he has a very, what we now call a disciplined background in classical music. And this suits the Beatles perfectly because he's able to take the Beatles' sort of raw musicianship. You know, the Beatles never learned to read or write music. So the Beatles come from an oral tradition, right? And they pair up with their producer, George Martin, who actually helps them notate things.
Yeah.
So we literally have Paul McCartney saying, I want the solo to go like this, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And Martin notates it for him.
Never could read or write music, and yet they're the Beatles, the biggest musical act ever. I mean, you say he made possible this marriage of high and low culture. He had the classical training, they had the native feel. Off it went.
Well, it's the marriage of high culture, which is classical music tradition. And he was curiously, I mean, well-schooled in all different periods of classical music, but very much a Claude Debussy nut, right?
Love it.
And so he loves to paint colors in his sounds. But more important than that, he has an open-mindedness. So he's a classically trained musician who will actually listen to rock and roll and say, ah, it has these properties. Let's work within these strictures of the style and make it more rock and roll. Let's not try and make it classical. Let's make it better rock and roll. And that's a very important kind of attitude and open-mindedness to have about it.
He signs them despite what he thinks of their music. He sees the charisma. 1963, first single by the Beatles to be released in the United States. Martin asked the Beatles to speed up the song, title track, 1963 debut album. Okay, they wanted to play it slow, like a Roy Orbison song. He says, no, speed it up, make it this jaunty rocker. What's the impulse?
Well, the impulse is he's listening to the material, and he's able to disassociate the material from the arrangement. And he's able to say, you know, if we arrange this differently, we might have a hit record. And it's the first song they bring to him where he actually feels excited about that. Now, so there's a two-way communication here that develops that's very, very important on both ends. The Beatles willing to accept a producer's directive.
And they were not rollovers.
They had very strong opinions, and they were pushing very hard to do their own original material, which was very unconventional and not standard practice. He wanted them to do other people's material. They did it reluctantly for him, but he could hear that they were investing more in their own material. And with his suggestions, they turned Please Please Me into an up-tempo number, and it actually works better. Now, I have never heard a demo of the slow tempo version of this.
I haven't either.
But when you imagine it done more slowly, you imagine a certain kind of bathos in the sound.
Well, you can hear, if you slow it down, it could be a Roy Orbison song.
It could.
Very close, actually.
Right.
He could sing it, Roy.
Right. So the fact that that both parties are able to listen to each other and work together to improve the material, right? So this is the thing, is that the focus is on the material, not so much, I better let these songwriters get a couple songs in to please them. It's like, let's work with the material and see if we can make it better. And the Beatles willing to accept good notes from a producer who knows what he's doing and actually incorporate it into a sound makes it sound very naturalistic and like it was always meant to be that way. That's another important piece. So you can have really good producers, but artists who aren't willing to work with them. You can have great artists who come into producers who don't know what to do with the material.
Yeah,
here
yeah.
we have the perfect marriage of the two sides.
It's just dazzling to think about this marriage of talents. We're going to come back and listen to a lot more about how this evolved, what it brought to the world, an incredible sound, and really a very, very collaborative sound of the Beatles as it evolved, as it sort of launched a kind of revolution. Tim Riley is with us this hour. We are talking about the man who helped make the Beatles. Sir George Martin died this week at 90. Listeners, you can join us. Have you been hearing the George Martin story all this week? Have you pulled out the old tracks and now hear the influence? Do we always gloss over how big, how important a great producer can be with great performers, even with, especially with, the Beatles? 1965, Rubber Soul, In My Life. John Lennon asked him to write a piano solo suggesting something Baroque sounding, drew right on George Martin's background. Tim Riley, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before. I know I'll often stop and think about them. There will be a show tonight on Trampoline.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the man who helped invent, create the Beatles, Sir George Martin, dead this week at 90, the producer who heard what they could be and helped them get there, the so-called often fifth Beatle. The great Tim Riley is with us, author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles, Album by Album, Song by Song, and Lennon, The Math, The Man, The Myth, The Music. We're going to hear in a few moments from Jeff Emerick, excuse me. He was the engineer who won a Grammy for work on the album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which of course had Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, 1967, behind us right here. You can join us as well. Do you remember when the Beatles went from Yeah, Yeah, Yeah to that super dimensional sound? And once you listen, can you not ignore George Martin's classical influence, the Baroque, the show tune styling, the studio wizardry, inventiveness? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Sarah in Lake Zurich, Illinois. Sarah, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Tim Riley.
Hi there. Thank you very much. I have been listening for a couple years to the show Breakfast with the Beatles here in Chicago, and I love them so much. And, you know, I guess recently I'm appreciating more how they simply could not have been the Beatles without George Martin. And And I'm also just, I've been so sad that George Martin outlived both John and George, and how they died is so sad. And I wanted to ask, okay, we have this lovely statement from Paul McCartney about George Martin, and what did John say about George Martin before he died, and what do you think he might have said at this point?
Great, Sarah. Thank you very much. Tim Riley.
Well, Lennon had a lot of respect for George Martin, especially the way he worked on particular songs. And Lennon, of course, was
not an easy man to pull over to your side.
Not quickly. Right. And, you know, he made some statements that probably George Martin would not have admired. Lennon often spoke about how he always wanted to re-record Strawberry Fields Forever, which is a marvel of engineering and a very interesting technical problem that George Martin solves. But Lennon always felt like he wanted another shot at it. Well, the rest of the world just sort of looks in awe at that piece of production and at the song itself and thinks, "This, how could it have turned out any better?" But no, Lennon had a great deal of respect for George Martin. And the other thing that he said late in his life that I always found curious was they were asking him, what about those mixes on the stereo albums where you have the drums over on the left and you have these instruments on the right and it's always different song to song and you never know what to expect and things go from left channel to right channel? And Lennon just kind of laughed and said, "Yeah, I've been meaning to ask George about that. Some of those mixes sound really funny to me." And it's like, you mean you weren't there helping make decisions about how things were mixed? And now we think that the Beatles actually were much more involved with the mono mixes than the stereo mixes, because mono was much more standard and mainstream until their very last couple of records.
Talk about being right in the thick of it. That means he was really running with this. Here's Martin himself. This was in a 1992 documentary, The Making of Sgt. Pepper, Lonely Hearts Club, and talking about how he saw the role of the producer change during his time working with the Beatles. Here's Sir George.
The role of a producer had changed over the years. I mean, when we started in 1962, my job was really an organizer to get them into some kind of shape, make sure they were tidy in the studio, musically, I mean. And gradually that changed. By the time Pepper had come along, I suppose I was a realizer of their ideas. So that if John wanted something really weird, I had to try and provide it for him. Or if Paul wanted some extraordinary orchestration, I had to try and find out what he wanted.
And he did. Started very early on, even in big old familiars like Love Me Do, 1962.
Love me do, whoa, love me do.
We're going to hear in just a second from the great audio engineer Jeff Emmerich, who was right in the middle as this sound became much, much more elaborate. But even right there, so early, first single released in the UK, I think, and that whole harmonica riff at the beginning? George Martin.
Well, so it was a very important piece of the early sound that we tend to forget about was that harmonica and also the duet between John and Paul. The other detail I like to point out in that early, which pervades a lot of their early records, is this very suspenseful silence that they interject just before the title line. And when you're dealing with silence in the middle of a 2.5 minute or 3 minute
it's a big
single
deal,
you're playing with the properties of sound in a very, very masterly way. And I think it's one of the early things that George Martin recognized. Even though the song itself we don't think of as a very strong piece of material, what they invest in it and the kind of the surge of feeling that you get from that arrangement is undeniable. And so it was kind of a reluctant act of his to put out Love Me Do instead of this other song that he had them sing, written by a professional songwriter called How Do You Do.
But they wanted Love Me Do. He went with it.
Right.
This harmonica, please.
And so this charted at number 17. And it was just enough to get the foot in the stirrup to get them recognized. And now we hear this as a very, very sweet-sounding debut. It's almost like a love letter from a middle schooler.
Yes, but there's a little minor note in there, too.
Oh, yeah, no. It also has a lot of Everly Brothers in it, too. So it's very much like a love letter to rock and roll. Yeah. And that is enough to carry it over.
Right in the middle of that amazing history, the rest would be history, was Jeff Emmerich. great engineer, worked closely with Sir George Martin, won Grammys for his engineering work on the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper Lonely Hearts Club Band, Abbey Road albums, worked on the Beatles with their other albums Revolver, the 1968 The Beatles. He's author of Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life, Recording the Music of the Beatles. And we are delighted that Jeff Emmerich joins us right now from London. Jeff Emmerich, thank you so much for being with us this week of all weeks.
Oh, you're welcome. Hi there.
Hi. So just paint a picture of George Martin for us. I mean, we picture the Beatles and all their beads and long hair and outlandish, wonderful garb ultimately, but he was always the straight guy, I'm reading here, Jeff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, except that gradually, of course, over time, it sort of diminished because of his, you know, involvement with working with them, you know.
Yeah. Take us back into the working relationship that you saw firsthand with the Beatles, with George Martin, with yourself right in there as engineer. What was the flavor of their interaction, Jeff?
Well, I mean, I would obviously worked as an assistant engineer on the very early things, and then when Norman Smith, the original engineer, left, you know, I took over from Norman, and I was the engineer on Revolver. But basically, George sort of gave a... First of all, let's start. There's a rock and roll band and a producer who's used to doing middle-of-the-road records and comedy records, which sounds like a very odd combination.
Yes. Yeah.
So gradually, I guess the two... you know, because as we know, on the very first sessions, it was very, very, the protocol at EMI was very, very sort of stiff and strict and stuff, and he was the schoolmaster and they were the band, but that soon got broken down. But George sort of, again, because of his background and working with this pop band, he could apply his knowledge of not necessarily heavy classical music, but mm-hmm. other things that he could interject into their music by adding, well, you know, instead of going to that chord, why don't you try going to that chord?
Mm-hmm.
And his forte really was working with the harmony vocals with them. It was always a great sense of humor because that brushed off onto me. We both got the same sense of humor. And there was also, so most of the sessions were just, there's always a sense of fun on them, you know, which drew out a lot of the artistic detail from the artist. It's a good thing, you know, that producers can do, which is the job, is to draw as much out of the artist as you can.
I mean, the world was listening and kind of agog at how the Beatles' sound just kept changing, kept becoming more and more interesting and rich. I think for a lot of people, not knowing what was going on, it was kind of mind-blowing. You thought, how do they do this?
Well, because really, the word demanding is not the right word, but they wanted to... They wanted to push forward and be different. They didn't want their records to sound like Cliff Richard and the Shadows, and that's really what happened. How can we make it so different? And that's what we strive for, you know?
And pretty soon they were in very different territory. Strawberry Fields Forever, this was off Magical Mystery Tour, 67. George Martin had a pretty tough time producing. The Beatles had recorded different versions. Martin created a different score for each. John Lennon said he wanted to combine them. Even though they were in different keys, recorded at different speeds, Martin made it work. See if you can notice the spot where they merged together here.
Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields Forever.
That merger, about 10 seconds back with the deep note, comes in under Tim Riley. Say hi to Jeff Emmerich in London. Jeff to Tim Riley, who's a huge fan of yours. Tim.
Jeff, I'm so happy to meet you over the radio. I'm such an admirer of all of your work. I'm really curious to hear more detail about that specific edit in Strawberry Fields Forever. We know that there's a band take, and then there's a second take with strings and brass, and that you helped George Martin combine those two takes right at about 1 minute in. And I'm very curious about the details of that. Can you remember that session?
Well, yeah, sure I can, because John said, you know, that's what he wanted to do after doing the two different versions, you know, after a couple of weeks. Oh, I like the beginning of the first one, but I like the rest of the second version. Well, there's two different tempos and two different keys, and so it's impossible, but the word impossible or can't or no never was used on any of our sessions. In some way, it was possible. So it was a question of copying the two mixes, and what I did was to gradually, I might get this the wrong way around, I've got a load going in my head at the moment, but so I sped up or slowed down the first version to marry up with the tempo and the key of the second version, and they were on vary speed on the tape machine.
Right.
And the second version was on vary speed, and then I gradually either slowed the second one down so it was a combination 50% of each version.
Right.
And then the edit, of course, wasn't just like a 45 degree edit on the tape. We're talking about quarter inch tape now.
Right.
So I did a very long sort of splice on the tape, so I made a little template up. So it was more like a crossfade.
Right.
And of course, you know, we're thinking this is never going to work, and we played it, and it did. And when we played it to John, George and I stood in front of the tape machine, so John didn't see the tape going past the head, so he wouldn't know where the edit was. And it actually worked. It was just fantastic.
That's fantastic.
What a great moment.
I've always wanted to ask this, though. Why was the other version in a different key? Why did you do it? Do you remember why they played it? The band played it in one key, but when you had the string and brass.
I've got no idea.
Yeah.
this stage, because I know when all that cacophony at the end. George Martin and I had gone to a film premiere that night. I think it was a game, and I was referring to Cliff Richard. And we came back, and it was like midnight, and they were doing this, you know, ridiculous amount of, you know, raucous noise and timps banging and God knows what else. Why the key was different? Obviously, it was to give it a slightly different mood, I would guess.
Yeah.
The keys were very close. I know that. They weren't very far apart.
Jeff Emmerich, do you remember the Beatles and George Martin just sitting around talking about the sound they wanted to achieve, or was it all over the work itself? Did they sit back and say, characterize where they wanted to go, or just plunge forward in the work?
No, they just plunged, because, you know, most of those records were instrumentally worked out in the studio. They normally just came in with a lyric. They had some idea of the instrumentation for a song. We might sort of record it that way for 5 hours and decide it's not the right instrumentation. And because it gave me the luxury of time. So what normally used to happen, you know, George would like be working musical things out with them. But I always used to sort of find a dominant sound that I liked down in the studio while they were rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started to build up the mix and stuff, because nothing was done on the mix. I mean, I'm talking about combining all the instruments live on the studio. So I used to like paint a picture with all the tonalities. And that's the way it sort of used to work.
And who was the last word, Jeff? Or was there a last word? Who said, we've got it? Was it John? Was it George Martin? Someone else?
Really, up in the control room, basically, you've got it. And we always knew when George said, we all knew together, my assistant, me and George, because we'd be doing recording these things for hour upon hour upon hour on the basic rhythm track. And we knew when it was the one, you know, because we didn't edit then either. If we didn't edit two takes together to make one up, it was always a complete performance on the basic rhythm track.
Right, even on a very complicated number like Day in the Life, that's one basic master track.
It's incredible.
Well, I mean, but that was made up. Although we laid down the original vocal and rhythm track.
Right.
The gaps where the orchestra are, where the orchestra is, were just gaps.
Right.
And then no one knew what was going to go in those gaps, believe it or not. And it was like an after, let's put some cacophony in there. I mean,
right.
No one knew. And then, you know, Paul had, you know, woke up, got out of bed. That wasn't planned.
Right.
And it was a coincidence that the alarm clock came in before that, you know, woke up, got out of bed thing happened.
Huh.
That was really a coincidence. It was Mal Evans who was counting the bars during that gap with the alarm clock going off. To alert anyone that the last bar was coming, and I couldn't get rid of it on Ringo's drum mics or the percussion mic he was using. So that's why it's on the record.
But it's brilliant that you left it in.
Jeff, we've got a call for you from Nashville. Can you stick around to take it? 1 second?
Yeah, sure.
Mark in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on with Jeff Emmerich.
Hey, Tom. I had a two-part question.
Make it quick. Our time's short.
Okay, if Tim can elaborate. First, John asked, I heard in an interview with Sir George, John asked him to put at the end of Good Morning the animal noises, and each consequential animal had to be higher in the food chain, A. And B, George said that they learned everything they knew for Sergeant Pepper's on Yellow Submarine.
Our time is short, but Jeff, animal noises at the end of Good Morning?
Yeah.
Climbing the food chain? Do you remember that? And what about tech?
I remember John saying that, because I think there's a picture of my notes in the book. John wanted it started with the dog chasing the cat, let's say, and the cat chasing the mouse, the dog chasing the cat, and then there was a lion chasing the dog, and then there was an elephant chasing something else, and the tiger was chasing that. So it went up into a more aggressive animal. Yeah, that came from John, yes.
Jeff Emmerich, we are so honored to have you for a few minutes in this week of the passing of Sir George Martin. We are very grateful and give you our great thanks for joining with us today.
You're welcome.
Jeff Emmerich, a famed audio engineer, worked very closely with George Martin and the Beatles on so many of their big 60s songs and sounds, author of Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life, recording the music of the Beatles. Tim Riley, please stand by. It's great to have you right here. We're talking about the man who helped invent the Beatles, evolved with them, Sir George Martin, dead this week at 90. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the man who helped invent the Beatles. The legendary producer Sir George Martin died this week at 90. He heard what they could be and helped them get there. With his own background in classical music, show tunes, humor, inventiveness of all kinds, right alongside John and Paul and George and Ringo. Hey Jude behind us, single, 1968, recorded using an 8-track recording machine. It was their longest-running number one song in the United States. Number one spot for 9 weeks. A long song, too. Tim Riley is with us this hour, author and rock culture chronicler, author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles, album by album, song by song, Lennon, the man, the myth, the music. You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. What strikes you today in this music and in this marriage of talents, of producer and performers? Are you taken again with the joy and inventiveness in the Beatles' music? 800-423-TALK. You know, Tim, it was so great to have Jeff Emmerich with us, who was right in the middle of all this. And then the out, Eleanor Rigby there, you know, that great string octet that George Martin brought in, that staccato string section in the chorus, maybe one of the most recognizable orchestral elements in pop music. I mean, we came later in popular music to think of the orchestral element as, oh, no, here comes the, ugh, you know, the kind of mud.
Yeah.
But in his hands and theirs, it was somehow marvelous.
Well, this was part of the impulse to be different, right? So when George Martin first suggests strings on Yesterday, McCartney is like, no, I don't think that's it. We're a rock and roll band, and this is a slow ballad, but I don't want strings on it. And George Martin suggests, well, what about a quartet? What if we just go towards the chamber music end? So it's not a full string section with all that syrupy glop that you're talking about, but actually it's more refined, and we'll be able to orchestrate the voices a little bit more, have some more definition. It'll be more intimate. And so McCartney said, well, I don't know. And George Martin said, well, let's try it. And if you don't like it, then We don't have to do it. So we went over to Martin's house the next day, and they worked out this arrangement. And McCartney became absolutely fascinated with how much potential and how you could be very, very controlled with your string quartet arrangement. And he fell in love with the idea, and they did it with string quartet. And, of course, it was great. Everyone could hear. But it was not the kind of thing that any other pop group was doing. And it was a very radical and, you know, a kind of oddly futuristic gesture to adopt a classical string quartet and put it in a Beatles recording, because it just would never have occurred to anybody else. So we have the openness, we have the intelligence, we have the classical background. And again, two creative minds kind of listening to one another and being willing to work with each other and say, oh, let's try this.
And sometimes three and four and five. Here's a day in the life from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, 67, written independently by Lennon and McCartney. Two different chunks they wrote this in. George Martin wrote the orchestral bits that link the song together. A day in the life.
I'm way upstairs and had a smoke, and somebody spoke and I went into a dream.
Riley, help us. That fabulous sort of trippy merger there. Whose fingerprints on what, and George's role, Martin?
So, you know, this track would be impossible if they hadn't worked together for a long time to figure it out. Because Lennon brings a song in, and McCartney contributes his portion to the song, but it's unlike any other song they've collaborated on together. And it's a song that has two different narrators. So Lennon narrates the verses, and then Paul McCartney kind of drops in his, it's a different song. It's like a song within a song, right? And it's a separate narrator. But each of these narrators at the end of their sections goes off into a reverie, almost like a dream world. So I'd love to turn you on, and they drift off. McCartney's section actually says, I had a puff, and then I went into a dream. And so there's this wonderful suggestion that Lennon is dreaming McCartney, or McCartney is dreaming Lennon. So it's almost the perfect metaphor for that songwriting partnership. And to be able to join those different sections together with the orchestral interlude. And what Lennon wanted was a sound of cacophony and of a rising orchestral orgasm. Mm. And so what Martin did was he said, I want you to all start on this note and end on this note, and I want you all playing different notes as you glide upwards. So they played without a score, right? And he conducted. And, you know, you could only do that if you had great technical proficiency and you understood how to talk to an orchestra. And you've got, you know, players from the London Symphony Orchestra sitting there, right? Some of whom are doing it really for the check and who hate rock and roll.
Yeah.
But you win their trust.
You can't
you're
hate
George
this.
Martin. And you're saying, okay, I want you to start on this note and where I'm going to count whatever it is, 12 bars, 18 bars, and then you're going to climax on this note. And he got them to do it. And, of course, it's one of the most surreal effects in all of rock and roll recordings.
Yes.
And it works beautiful. It sounds completely like, oh, this was meant to be this way. But you heard Jeff Emmerich say they had blank tape. They didn't know what was going to fill in there, right? So it takes a very, very – they were very, very intimate with each other in terms of the creative process. Martin understanding what the song needed, right, and following their very, very sketchy – instructions of here's how we think the orchestra might sound, right? And going and just running with it, getting it.
You want to know why collaboration matters in genius? It's right there, right there. New York, Coventry, John is calling. John, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
So much. Kind of in the same vein here, I've been a big Beatles fan since the very beginning, and what I thought was always so great about them is that their music was simple without being simplistic, yet sophisticated without being obscure. And George Martin was definitely a huge part of that. And their music will just last forever.
You're calling it just right, I think, John. Just right. And I appreciate your call. Maura Johnston is with us right now. Tim, stand by. Writer, editor, music critic, editor of Maura Magazine, an online culture publication. She follows music inside and out. And Maura, thank you so much for being with us. Think about this sound that George Martin helped emerge with the Beatles and roll us forward for just a second. Maura, does it live, this kind of collaboration or the ideas that came out of it? Is it still influential today? You follow a lot of new music.
Yes. I mean, absolutely. The term Beatles-esque has been used, you know, to describe so many bands and songs, from ELO to, you know, even songs by the likes of New Kids on the Block. And then you have artists like the ones in the Alice and Chicks Collective who, you know, became very well known for kind of doing what Martin did as far as like boiling down the really rudimentary tools and then using them to create big sounds. But for me, I think what Martin also represented was a sense of whimsy, a sense of, you know, sort of anything can happen. Like, you know, you can add an orchestral suite to a song and make it better. It's funny because this was maybe 10 years ago now, the band Super Free Animals, they're a psych rock band out of Wales. They did a song called Receptacle for the Respectable, and they had Paul McCartney on it, and his solo was him chewing carrots and celery. know, so it's kind of
chewing carrots and celery. Let's have some whimsy.
It's a percussive element, you know?
Yeah, why not? Why not Paul McCartney chews a carrot? Listen to this for a second. This was Let It Be, 1970, later on, but produced by George Martin. Now, Phil Spector produced the album version. Big difference comes at the guitar solo. Spector took his wall of sound approach, used a different take on the solo, but Martin's version here has a later take of George Harrison's solo, mixed it so it's a bit more understated. Tim Riley, what about where this kind of collaboration went? I mean, Maura hears it today, maybe not as much as she'd like, but she hears it. Some people took it and went to the full wall of sound, Phil Spector. Some took it into kind of syrup.
You bring up a very controversial period for the working relationship between the Beatles and George Martin, because they forged ahead to make the Let It Be sessions without George Martin. Mm. They famously did it. We see him in one scene in the movie, he shows up and he's listening, but for the bulk of those sessions in January 1969, there is no producer. There's simply a film crew, and the Beatles are working out rehearsals on their own. And
how does Spector figure in?
Well, they bring Spector in much later to rescue the tapes. They filed those tapes away and put them on the shelf, and they said, this is terrible, we don't want to even think about this.
Had they fallen out with George? What happened?
Well, George is on record as being very kind of miffed about how he was treated during these sessions. Mm-hmm. They did not include him, and they did not call on him to produce the tapes when they decided a year later in 1970, we need a record, and let's brush up those old tapes. They called Phil Spector because they saw Phil Spector as this magical wizard who could come in and
new guy.
Magic. And he does, but it's very controversial what Phil Spector does with him. So, for example, he arranges Long and Winding Road with a huge string section and a female choir. And Paul mm-hmm. McCartney really hates that version of Long and Winding Road. And we know that Martin would never have done that.
So Martin's back in, though, for this version of Let It Be somewhere.
Well, you know, I'm not sure which version you're playing. I'm actually puzzled where you found that, and I'm not exactly sure. I know there's several different guitar solos that Harrison turns in for that track, but it's unclear to me that Martin ever puts his fingertips or gets his fingerprints on any of the Let It Be tapes until we get to Let It Be Naked, and that is something that he probably had some role in, but not a producer credit. So I'm unclear what's going on there.
Duly noted. We'll mark that. Maura Johnston, you say look at maybe the 1975 now, or the band Quilt lately with its orchestration, to hear a little echo over time of George Martin's work with the Beatles.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, even artists like, you know, the R&B singer Miguel has brought in, I think, the elements of just this really expansive sound and breaking down pop music so that it has these more arranged elements and, you know, is something sort of, you know, grander than it might be as initially written.
Maura, thanks so much for being with us today for a minute. Maura Johnston there with Maura Magazine.
You.
Thank you very much. Of course, George Martin would go off and do work of his own. Goldfinger, 1964. He produced Shirley Bassey's, well, you know the sound.
For a golden girl knows when he's kissed her. It's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
Okay, there's another sound from Martin, Tim Unleashed from the Beatles.
Yeah, well, so this is the kind of gig that you get when you become the famous Beatle producer that James Bond people call you and say, hey, will you produce this for us? So he does the Shirley Bassey thing. I always thought this was a hilarious recording because it's so melodramatic. And so it's like you would never listen to that and think, oh, yeah, they got the Beatle producer to do that, right? Because it's just very, very formulaic and dated.
Yeah,
this is part of the career of George Martin. Part of what we hear is his work with the Beatles veers towards the magical, right? Mm. His work with other people tends not to. Even though he has hits with America and Jeff Beck and Cheap Trick and works with many other people, of course, highly respected, very respectable recordings. Mm-hmm. But we never talk about any other recordings that he makes as veering towards the magical.
And, well, maybe this one, 1997, George Martin, Elton John, re-recording Elton John's 1972 song, Candle in the Wind, as a tribute to Princess Diana after her death. The addition of strings, Martin's doing, one of the best-selling singles of all time.
And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when rain set in. And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend.
The George Martin touch there on Elton John's Candle in the Wind. And of course, Tim Riley, what about the long-term relationship between George Martin and the Beatles? I mean, we've seen the outpouring from them this week. God bless George Martin, Ringo Starr says. Paul McCartney saying George Martin was like a second father to me. Did it hold up in the relationship itself over the years?
Oh, yeah. And they all draw on him, and McCartney uses him several times for several important solo albums. The key thing to recognize about George Martin and his work with the Beatles is that there's actually a major accomplishment here embedded in everything that we've been talking about, which is that they actually elevate this idea of a recording into a new aesthetic realm, okay? So when we listen to a Beatle recording like A Day in the Life, what we come away with is we don't think, oh, what a great song, and oh, I can't wait to hear that song in concert.
It's not just a
someday.
Stage act on tape.
Right. We hear a recording. We hear an ideal version of that song that has been imprinted on tape, and the ideal version of that song will always be that recording of
it. And the recording itself becomes a work of art, not just the stage performance.
Exactly. And no, so this had been the industry had been pointed in this direction for a while, and we see Frank Sinatra reaching towards it in the 50s, say, where a concept album is something that actually has that idea emerges at first with albums like Songs for Swingin' Lovers.
Mm-hmm.
But the Beatles actually take this much further and turn it into kind of accepted wisdom. Yes, the ideal version of a Beatles song is the Beatles performing that song on tape, and the recording, you are not going to go out and try and replicate that recorded experience in the live arena. So when we go hear a live band play a Beatles song, we immediately submit to, there is no expectation that it's going to be anywhere near as ideal a version of that as we have on the recording.
Accepted wisdom or pinnacle after pinnacle. In 2006, George Martin, along with his son, produced a soundtrack for the Cirque du Soleil show in Las Vegas, worked on an archive of recordings to create new but recognizable music. Here's that version of All You Need Is Love. George Martin, Sir George, died this week at 90. What an incredible collaboration. Good luck for all of us that it happened. And our deep thanks to you, Tim Riley, for taking us into it today. Thank you so much for being
here.
My
pleasure, Tom.
Tim Riley, author of Tell Me Why and Lennon. All You Need Is Love. Thanks for joining us today. Thank you, Sir George Martin and the Beatles. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.